This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, we air a forum looking at the vilification of and distrust in the media, the network of journalists, reporters, editors, producers, and newscasters that gather and dispense the news. Referred to by many names, the press, the media, the Fourth Estate, or the Great Bulwark of Freedom, these organizations and individuals play an essential role in democracy and society and enjoy a long history in America, enshrined in the Constitution through the First Amendment in 1791. Addressing the role of the press, the threat of misinformation, and the need for critical consumption of the news is Jennifer Napier Pierce, former executive editor of the Salt Lake Tribune and frequent voice on this program. Napier Pierce, a veteran journalist and former reporter, host, and producer for KCPW, resigned from her position as executive editor earlier this month. Her last day was August 14th, following just short of her four-year anniversary as head of the Salt Lake Tribune. During her interim, the Salt Lake Tribune won a Pulitzer Prize in 2017 for coverage of campus rape and transitioned to a new nonprofit organization in 2019. This forum was recorded on April 10th, 2019. Here is Jennifer Napier Pierce.
I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. I'm the editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. We are Utah's independent voice. We've been around since 1871. And I'm really thrilled to be here to talk about fake news versus fact. It is your reality, it is all of our realities, and I think it does affect everyone sitting in this room and beyond. Some simple definitions when we talk about fake news. What images, what words does that conjure up in your mind? Shout them out. Thoughts? Feelings?
Propaganda.
Propaganda. Very good. What else? Nothing else? Really? Alternative facts. Okay, good, 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 good. I'm going to put a simple definition out there for you to consider. False stories presented as fact. So let's break it down. False, right? These are lies. These are false stories presented as fact. For what? Financial or political gain. We see this throughout history, which I'll go through in a moment. But there are different types of misinformation, and you can look at it as a spectrum. I mean, the first one really is it's supposed to be funny. It's supposed to make you laugh. Satire and parody is on one end of the spectrum. And then on the other end, it's manipulated content, it's complete lies, fabrication, designed to deceive or to do harm. So there's different variations along that spectrum. And you guys know this already, right? You see this online, you see this in all sorts of venues, and you have to decide. It makes it really hard. You as a consumer have to make the judgment call. Is this deliberately supposed to make me laugh, or is this supposed to intentionally harm me or somebody else? And it's hard when you have all these different variations. So a little quiz. Okay, so these are from last year. Vows in the Air is the headline. German couple married in a tightrope wedding. Here's the photo. Here's a little bit of the story. A couple in Eastern Germany have gotten married in a swing, dangling from a motorcycle atop a tightrope. Fact or fiction? Who says fact? Who says this is real? Oh, a little sheepishly. Who says this is fiction? Many of you are not voting. Why are you not voting, right? Okay, the answer is fact. This is fact. If I had shown you the byline, it would have been from the Associated Press. This is not a fabricated photo. And this was verified by not only Associated Press, but the German news agency, DPA. Those are all clues for you as the consumer that this has been verified. Okay, let's try another one. Trump Tower opens in Pyongyang. This came out within a week of Trump's visit to North Korea. Okay, Trump Tower, you have an image, you have a byline, you have a date. Trump Tower has opened in Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea, in what is being hailed as a breakthrough after a historic meeting between President Trump and North Korean Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un. Fact or fiction? Who says this is a fact? 0%. Who says this is fiction? What tipped you off? What tipped you off?
It doesn't have any kind of a byline or any kind of a sponsor on that or whatever you call it.
Well, it does have a byline. It has a name.
What I mean is a sponsor, like, you know what I'm saying? Like an agency, some kind of a
okay.
news source.
Fair.
You have a news source.
Yeah, go ahead.
The building's not gold.
Did you see? Okay, so this was one of the premier meetings around the world. Did you see this in any reputable news source? The answer is no. And I think that if you don't see a lot of news coverage about an item, that can tip you off. Like, that has got to be somebody's imaginary story, right? It's a really bad Photoshop, by the way. So, okay, here's another one. Breaking: Shep Smith to be canned because he can't control his hate for Donald Trump. Fact or fake? Who says fact? Who says fake? Many of you have abstained. Okay. Why was this one a little harder? Yeah.
I feel like there's probably like elements of it that are drawn from the truth, but it's not 100% factual.
Okay, good, good, good. Any other clues that tipped you off thinking this might not be reality? This is the URL up here. News Today in USA Update. Really? Okay. That sounds like somebody typing away in their basement. It was. This is actually a story that started circulating in 2015. And it just keeps going and going. And it was republished June 9th of 2018. When you see a story that is recycled over and over and the content really doesn't change and it's not from a reputable news source or some place that you've never heard of, those are tips. Those are little nuggets that should make you question. Okay? So that is fake. Last one. A woman went to check her corn and was swallowed by a python. Fake or fact? I unfortunately don't have a photo with this picture. Or maybe fortunately, I don't know. Who says it's fact? This is for real. Who says it's for real? Who says this is somebody's imaginary story? Oh, okay. What tipped you off? Yeah.
There's no like way to get political gain out of it, so falsify it.
Right. I mean, you could look at that and you might think, oh, is this a joke? Is this satire? But really, there's nobody who's going to be benefiting from such an awful tragedy. This actually happened. This was published in the New York Times. And it's also verified here by the Jakarta Post. And there's an embedded link in the story. So if you really wanted to go and do a little bit of exploratory verifying on your own, you have sources within the story. Quite often, fake news stories do not share sources because they're made up, right? So that was indeed a fact. You talked about propaganda. The first mention of the word, it was invented in 1622, had to do with the Catholic Church, another topic. Yellow journalism, as a term, was coined in 1898, started a war. Yeah, so we could go into history for a long time, but I want to fast forward to 2006. So what made 2006 so interesting is that we've always had propaganda. We've always had people who wanted to exploit the thoughts, the feelings, the emotions of others for their political gain or their financial gain. But what happened in 2006 was really the rise of social media. And this made a huge difference because these stories could be shared around the world in a split second, right? So we see, this is from the Pew Research Center. They started tracking social media venues from 2012, and this ended last January, 2018. So you can see that in the US, the vast majority of adults now have access to either YouTube or Facebook. They're using them all the time. This is a year old data, so you know that the trend continues to grow. And when you have so many people automatically being publishers and being able to share all their feelings online, and it's instantaneous. I mean, that makes a huge difference in the spread of fake news. So before, you know, it might take a week, it may take a month for a fake letter to start circulating. Now it's in a minute, it's in a second. And it can be just spread so very quickly. And so I think that's why people have been nervous about fake news and its impact, because it is so easily accessible and everybody can spread it even if they don't do their homework. And then I would fast forward to the election of 2016. We really see this term fake news used in a different light. So you can see this tweet. This was before the election. Just watch the totally biased and fake news reports of the so-called Russia story on NBC and ABC. Such dishonesty. He could have sent this last night, right? We started to question our own reality very intensely in 2016. Are we all on the same page? Do we all have the same reference points, data points? Post-Truth named the word of the year. That was in 2016. 2017, the intensity continues. There's a lot of inflammatory language around fake news, and it evolves into the enemy of the people, which is a very destructive phase with a deep, dark history stemming back to Stalin. In November of 2017, fake news is coined the word of the year. In 18, we have the fake news awards. Again, the scrutiny is intensifying. We have this little clip. Oh, most of you were nodding, so you remember this little moment in time where the president calls out reporters and insults them, insults their institutions, insults the questions because he doesn't want to be asked questions that he doesn't like. I want to reaffirm to you, this is not a partisan issue for me. You can agree with President Trump and his policies, or you can despise him. What I'm talking about is the conversation around public policy issues and around degrading an institution, the Fourth Estate, that is core to our democracy. So I don't want you to think this is like a Trump bashing session. I'm not going there. There are plenty of other politicians who use this term now.
That's Jennifer Napier Pierce, editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today we are airing a talk given by Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier Pierce, entitled Fake News and Alternative Facts. Here again is Jennifer Napier Pierce.
Okay, this happened this weekend. Mark Zuckerberg, he called to regulate Facebook, and he explained why. Why is he being targeted for as part of the fake news debate?
People are getting their news from Facebook.
Right. I mean, when you look at the rise of social media and the percentage of Americans that are now getting their news from social media, you have to wonder to yourself, so does the platform have any responsibility in the spread of lies, the spreading of lies? This is not a phenomenon that's unique to the United States. We see this playing out in countries around the world. And particularly right now in the Indian elections, we saw this some horrific and it's not a fake news incident, but you can see the liabilities around the New Zealand shooting and how this guy was able to live broadcast this horrific event that he was perpetrating, and it stayed on and was shared, and it goes on and on and on. So I think that Zuckerberg and others in the social media space are feeling the heat, and they are trying to set regulation on their own terms, right? They're trying to set an agenda that will work for them, but also result in their financial gain. So that's a very interesting debate. This was the headline on Fox News this morning. So we have Representative Devin Nunes, who is suing the Fresno Bee because he doesn't like their coverage of him. They ask hard questions, and he's suing them for $150 million in a defamation suit. Experts, Republican, Democrat, it doesn't matter. Defamation is such a high standard, he's not going to win. But he is spinning this as a fake news incident. He wants to punish a newspaper that is critical of his policies. It's his hometown newspaper, and his election depends on it. He wants to label them as fake news. That was this morning. So fake news is everywhere, and it's being spread. So do you care? Who cares, really? What difference does it make in your life and the lives of others? I would throw out three ideas for you to consider. Fake news and the labeling of news as fake results in extreme distrust. The news business is, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, but the news business is founded on a trust relationship between publisher and reader. News is different from essays, from other forms of expression, other writing, fiction writing. It's different because it's been verified. And when you don't trust that anymore, it does shake the foundations of society. When you don't trust government, it does shake our community. So this is another Pew study. I believe this was 2018. Overall, a majority of the public supports news media's watchdog role. So there's a high level of trust that journalism, media should be trusted, right? Keeps political leaders in check. That's a theory. Sorry, this is 2017. But then you start to see a huge political divide, the widest that we've ever seen between Republicans and Democrats and their trust in the media. We see extreme distrust among Republicans in news media today. And when you live in a Republican state, a red state like that, as a practitioner of journalism, makes you think a little bit. It's a little bit scary. This was a Knight Foundation poll. 69% of US adults, this is over the past decade, they have a decreasing trust in the news. That's overall. That, to me, is such a troubling trend. 10 years of decline, and 69% feel that way. You can see the partisan breakdown. But I think the overwhelming, the political divide that we see happening in DC has shifted and resulted also in distrust in the people who are the messengers, right? A couple others, let's see. Public trust in government is also down, historically. So this is a Pew Center. I forgot to put the year on here. But you can see in the Trump era, we're near the very, very bottom of trust in our institutions. We're talking lawmakers, the executive, the courts, right? So that's one piece of why it matters to you. Second piece, I would argue, is election interference. So this is direct democracy. And we are seeing that fake news is influencing voters, okay? So multiple stories. You can see all of this from 2016 to 2018. We've got the Russian influence. We've got Facebook. Facebook has been making some changes, at least according to this MIT study last year, but it is not enough. It is not enough to eradicate fake news online. Australia, we've seen some fake news pop up there. In Brazil, I mentioned the Indian elections. So this has a lot of effect on our government and our systems that are in place to protect us and to help us accomplish what we want to as a community. And then thirdly, I would just point out that fake news can lead to violence. It is not violence, but it can lead to violence. As you can see, the t-shirt from Walgreens, yeah. Rope tree journalists, some assembly required. In the New York Times, we know that conspiracy theories fueled, do you remember Pizzagate? So I think it was InfoWars that was circulating this fake news story about how Hillary Clinton was operating a child sex ring out of a pizza joint in Washington, D.C. And these words translated into somebody bringing a gun to the pizzeria. Fortunately, nobody was hurt, but that does show that that words matter, that the pen can destroy people. It can lead to destructive behavior. And then, of course, we had this incident last fall with a man who sent bombs to various politicians, but he also included CNN. And his diatribes against the press and about reporting are well documented. He just pleaded guilty. I want to say it was this week or last. Anyway, so all of this is to say that it's harming our institutions. And when we look at the First Amendment, we notice that freedom of the press is enshrined in our most valuable document as a society. It's Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, right? So our founders knew the value of the Fourth Estate. They knew that they needed somebody looking in. It was just another check and balance on the government that they established. I don't think my video is going to work, so I'll skip it. This was, if I could have shown you, it would have been Republican Senator Jeff Flake, who just left the Senate, talking about the damage of using the terms fake news and labeling the press, the media, the news, as enemies of the people, and how destructive that can be on our democracy. I'm going to leave plenty of time for questions, so I hope you have some. This quote from Thomas Jefferson, I love it. Thomas Jefferson was a huge critic of the press that he personally received. He did not like the media at all. And he wrote in personal correspondence over and over how he thought it was vicious and he hated the coverage that he was getting, but he understood the value of having it. And he quoted, we're left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government. I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. He knew the value of free press. He knew that for us to be empowered as citizens, we had to have reliable information, right? So this is where you all come in. How can you tell fact from fiction? We talked about a few strategies, but as a prelude, I just want to tell you how journalism is really separate from other forms of communication. It is not advertising. It is not marketing. It is not blogging. It is not online journaling. It is not my thoughts on Twitter. It is a profession led by a code of ethics. So this is the Society for Professional Journalists Code of Ethics. I'll just point out a few highlights. As journalists, we seek truth. So we're trying to get to the bottom of things, right? And we want to disseminate that truth once we find it. As journalists, we want to act independently. And what that means is if I try and put when I was a reporter. I'm an editor now, so I spew opinion all the time. As a reporter, though, I kept that personal stuff close to the vest, right? And you have to. When I was a news director at another news organization, I had an intern come in, and she was wearing a T-shirt that said George W. Bush for president on it. I can't send her out to do any reporting for my organization because everybody would know where her personal allegiances were. So as part of this code of ethics, the reporters in my newsroom, they don't make political donations. They don't have bumper stickers on their car. They don't wear partisan symbols. They don't even have signage like vote for X in their front yard. This is hard for some reporters because obviously we want to be engaged. We want to be part of the mix and the communal conversation. But I think it's so important for us to try and be as detached as possible. Now, it's impossible. I mean, realistically, we all have biases, and we should not pretend that we don't have biases. On the other hand, should we be flamboyant about it? Should we go out there and advertise, I am a huge Obama supporter, and I hate everything about Trump? Would that reflect well on my institution as a messenger? And the answer, I would argue, is no. There's a lot of debate in the journalism space about this. Like, you know, some argue you should show your color so everybody knows. But the problem with that, it helps your personal brand, I feel, but not the institution. The institution as a fair broker. So SBJ would agree with me to act as independently as possible. Our ethical code includes being accountable and being transparent and showing you how we got to the story that we reported. And when we make mistakes, we go out there and tell you. We screwed up. We didn't get this right, blah, blah, blah. Do you know of any other industries, any other private enterprises that go out and say, sorry, over here, before they're caught? Right? This is not like after the fact. This is usually within a day. If we've gotten something wrong or we found out something that we reported earlier in the day had a different dimension to it, we want our readers to know that and to help them understand the process that we went through to get to the reporting. So we try and be as transparent as possible. And then finally, another core value is to minimize harm. I think as members of the journalism community quite often are seen as, gotcha, I'm out to get you. I'm gonna show everybody's flaws. That is true to a tiny degree for people who put themselves out as representatives in the public sphere. So there is a different standard of scrutiny, and I think rightly so, for people that we have elected. They have put themselves out there. So does it matter what their tax returns say? Yeah, actually it does. Because you, as a leader that we've elected, we want to know how you handle your personal finances because you're gonna be handling all of our money, right? That's why it's relevant. And so we're not out to get people just because. When we did a lot of reporting around campus sexual assault, our initial story resulted in, I want to say, 50 to 60 people coming out the first weekend after our initial story came out and saying, hey, that story sounds just like mine. And please tell it. Other people need to know about this. And, you know, it's gratifying for a news organization to feel like the public trusts you with their most intimate stories. So we loved that part of it, but there is a flip side to being public. And so when we did this reporting, we had to go to sexual assault survivors and say, are you sure you want your name in a Google search for the next 50 years? You know, are you sure you want to describe these really horrific things that happened to you? Are you ready for me to go to the police department and verify what you've told me? Are you ready for me to interview your family? Are you ready for me to interview your roommates? Are you ready for me to go and really spread your story out there? And so that's part of the minimizing harm. It's like, I don't think that people who are not voluntarily stepping out there, they need to, we want to make sure that they understand the implications of what that means for the rest of their lives. And a lot of people courageously said, yeah, bring it on. You know, this is my truth. This is what happened to me. And if it changes systems, fantastic. So, but minimizing harm really is a core value for us. I'll just quickly explain the reporting process. A lot of people, and I mean a lot of people, send me tips, which I think is fantastic. And they think they've got a story and it's going to be published, like that day. But let me just tell you, that is not the way it happens. That is the basis of rumors, and that's going to get you in a lot of trouble. So we get a tip on email, phone, whatever. I had a person show up at the newsroom yesterday with a hot, juicy tip. Here's the thing that most people don't understand is that tips have to be verified to be published as a news story. We can pass on a lot of hearsay and stuff if we were just a publisher, but as journalists, we would not do that. And so we have to verify it. We have to go through documents. We have to do a lot of interviewing. We want to see stuff ourselves. There are a lot of digital tools. So sometimes people will send us a photo and say, look at that. Look what's happening. And we need to make sure that it hasn't been manipulated, because there are a lot of tools out there that makes it very, very easy to Photoshop an image or to change context. And multiple sources really is key, right? If you're one person, you feel passionately about the story and you want it told, but I can't verify it, it can't go anywhere. it's not going to go anywhere. And then the reporter starts to write. So there's a lot of homework that goes into this. I will just say that the overlay on all of this is competition. We want to be first. And we also know that everybody else may have this juicy story, so we've got to like get it done. So all of this scrutiny is just, there's a lot of pressure that goes into journalism and into writing. But then you're still not done. There's this additional layer in journalism of editors. So every reporter has to go through an editing process, at least one editor. And if it's an investigative piece, I've been in a room with five editors, okay, to make sure that we've got this right. So the editor's role is to ask questions. Why did you talk to that person? Why didn't you talk to that person? What about these sources? How do you reconcile the differing accounts? We obviously check about the facts, but also the nuance of a story, how it is sequenced. So we're looking at structure. So there's a lot of questions that go into that. If you have thin skin, being a journalist is probably not for you, because you are always, always being scrutinized. And then finally, if it checks out, then you publish, right? So I hope that helps to explain how journalism really is very different from other forms of communication. Our scrutiny on campus sexual assault, as I mentioned, led to a Pulitzer Prize in 2017. The campuses that we focused on primarily were Brigham Young University and Utah State University, but the reporting sparked entire conversations across the state. Every campus and every community and every law enforcement agency was starting to think about the nature of consent and how do we, you know, process rape kits, and what about what should the process be for reporting a sex crime, and do we believe the people who come forward? I mean, all of these things, this predated Me Too, and then Me Too came very shortly after it. So I don't think it's exaggeration to say that this reporting made a huge difference for you, particularly as students, but for our entire community and state. So back to you and your role. Where can I turn, where can I go to find out truth? When you see a story and you're not sure, here are some great fact-checking websites. They will tell you whether or not it's a joke, and they will tell you whether or not it's fact. Here's some other tips that we talked about. Considering the source of a fake news story, going beyond just a headline. I have to say that a lot of people share within a split second. They see the headline, they agree with it, they share it without reading the entire article. So they could be completely innocently just wanting to inform the people in their social circles, and yet they're spreading lies, right? So taking a moment just to find out what the story really is about, checking the author. Again, you can do an easy search on any author and find out if they're even a robot or if they are a real human being. Looking at the links embedded within stories, checking the date. Again, there are old stories now circulating all over and over again. And if it doesn't really reveal anything about current events, that might be a tip off. Is it a joke? Is it too crazy? Looking at yourself, am I in a bubble? Am I only spreading what I personally believe, or has this been fact-checked in any way? And then also, of course, going to the fact-checking sites, asking experts. I hope, as I've just explained the process, that the Tribune is part of one of those reputable news sources that you can trust. When we get things wrong, we do tell you that we got things wrong. When we do publish a story, it has been vetted. It has gone through an editing process. And I think it's really important in this community because we have told stories that that few other news organizations have been able to tell.
That's Jennifer Napier Pierce, editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this last segment, Jennifer Napier Pierce answers questions from the audience of faculty and students.
Do you think it's not just people kind of getting tricked into watching these news articles, but it's also just people wanting to see these articles, and once they see something that confirms their biases, that's what gets them into it?
For sure. You know, there's a lot of information out there. And aren't you drawn to things that affirm you as a person? Of course, right? I just think that all of us can benefit from reading stories that challenge our personal beliefs. It makes you a better citizen. It makes you a better conversationalist, for sure, because you can see the other side of things. And I do think that sometimes you get caught in this narrow little canal and you can't get out. And part of that is the power of social media, because your friends tend to think like you, right? You like them because you identify with them, you understand them. You may come from a similar community. So, yeah, I do think that some of this is, it's a cycle, and it's hard to get out of. I think all of us as consumers of news need to make a conscious effort to get outside of your bubble.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for being here. Can you talk a little bit about the financial side of things? So, we think about fake news a lot with the political context, but what about the financial side, especially as you think about the financial models for today's newspapers, digital subscriptions? How do you balance this idea of finding things that are attractive for people to click on versus kind of going to the other side of that, and that's the only thing you're trying to do is get people to click on your articles?
I think that actually is one a popular misconception. We're only out for the clicks. The clicks don't pay for us. The clicks pay Google. The clicks pay Facebook. I mean, our traffic flows through these platforms, but we don't get the advertising revenue. That's why we're screwed, because historically, legacy newspapers have relied on advertising to fund the news side. So we've sold ads, but they're clearly marked. This is an ad, and it is not generated by the newsroom. And consumers understood that. Here's the other thing, the mobile device, right? If you have ads on your desktop, they're big, you can see them, and there are lots of them. If you have ads on your mobile device, they're tiny, and there's not very much space. And so even though, you know, we sell digital ads, we don't get a lot of revenue from it. That's why the financial model is broken. And that's why, you know, at the Tribune and other news organizations, we're trying to figure out a third way, because the old way does not work. It's just not going to work. And newspapers are not going to, they're not going to survive in the long term. They're costly to produce. It's ink, it's paper, it's somebody throwing it on your doorstep before dawn. So it's labor intensive. I don't have scale. So if, as newspaper subscribers drop off on my block, say I'm the only one, I still have to have the same driver driving around. So there's not a lot of efficiencies when it comes to print. As consumer attitudes shift to digital, we have to figure out a way to make money. And that's part of why we, as the Salt Lake Tribune, put up a paywall last year, because we've got to figure out a way to close the gap. We're just losing money.
So I'm wondering why the Salt Lake Tribune decided to continue to let Robert Kirby write after the allegations were made against him.
Okay. I can't get too detailed because it is a personnel matter. The allegations we did investigate. I will just say there are two sides to a pancake, every pancake. So he was dealt a very harsh, retribution. He had a punishment. 3 months without pay is not anything to sneeze at if you are a boss. I've had people who did what some would consider to be much worse for much less, but he's a public figure and he should be held accountable. After he accomplished the terms that we had set, I felt like he was ready to come back. So, and I made the call. And he remains controversial. Here's the thing. Humor is hard. It's very, very hard to be funny. And I pay him to be provocative. I pay all of my columnists to poke people. I mean, Pat Bagley does this every day. He goes out there and he pricks consciences and he makes sure that people are thinking a little bit differently. They're thinking outside of their bubble if they look at the cartoon. Love it or hate it, it makes you think, right? Similarly with humor columnists, it's difficult. But with any personnel issue, I have to handle them individually, and it can't be one person's account or versus another. It's almost like the reporting process that you go through.
Yeah, it's along the same lines of the news and the financial stuff that he was talking about earlier. The BBC referred to Christopher Blair as the godfather of fake news. I'm not sure if you've come across his story, but he literally tried to go straight and write important articles that came from his liberal outset of the life of the world. Noticed it didn't make any money, wrote a couple fake news articles, and they blew up. Yeah. It generated an incredible amount of revenue for him, and he stopped his regular job.
Yeah.
Is the government and our Google and our Facebook, are they working on that side of this equation to change it so that the fake news doesn't get all of the money? Because I understand why people are drawn to it, but it's the money. The money is what matters.
Right. I will say that I find it ironic that Facebook is pouring $300 million into local news, and Google is pouring $300 million into local news because they broke the system. Like, they broke something, and now they're trying to fix it. But when you think about all of the news organizations in this country and around the world, $300 million doesn't stretch very far. So, you know, I think that's why Zuckerberg is trying to get ahead on the regulation side. He may be feeling like, I got to do something as a business to continue to survive. And, you know, it is about the money. It is about the money. I'm not going to sell out and write salacious stories just so I can get a buck. That's not what our institution stands for at all. So, I don't know. We have to find another way. And
can
I think
you do a side hustle?
I could, but I'm not going to.
So how much influence does a media owner have in the style and the types of articles that are written?
I can only speak for my institution. The Salt Lake Tribune has a sole local owner. Now, that was not always the case. He bought the paper not quite 3 years ago. Before that, it was owned by a New York hedge fund, and they did not care at all, whatever. You know, they were... In that respect, it was great because they weren't hands-on. On the other hand, they raped and pillaged and cut our staff I don't know how many times. So that was awful. Having a sole local owner is a great benefit to our newsroom. It gives us a lot of stability. On the other hand, he's from a prominent family that's politically active, that's very active in charitable work. It makes some tricky reporting decisions. He does not have any influence on the day-to-day, none, zero. My communications with him are only about our editorial page. And traditionally, the editorial page, all opinion, is the publisher's playground, per se. He doesn't really take advantage of that. He looks at our editorial content. But other than that, we can publish whatever we want. So I feel very lucky that our publisher understands the relationship between the newsroom and ownership, right? Did any of you guys see the Post? A couple of people. This is about the Washington Post back in the Watergate days. And was it Watergate? No, it was the Pentagon Papers. Pentagon Papers. Anyway, you saw a little bit of the tension between their editor and their publisher, and their publisher wanted certain things, and the editor was like, no, hands off. I don't have those kinds of conversations with Paul, because he understands, like, we do this, and we have professional guidelines, and he trusts us. We do disclose, however, whenever his brother is in the news. John Huntsman Jr., at the end, you'll see a disclosure that says, John Huntsman is a brother of Paul Huntsman, who owns the Salt Lake Tribune. We want our readers to know what that relationship is. I actually talked to somebody this week who was making a strong, heartfelt argument that we put disclosures on too many things. And I don't think you can be too transparent. So I'm fine with it. Maybe you guys have different views, but he was like, why do you have to put Huntsman on, you know, everything, like Abby Huntsman? I'm like, well, because she's his niece and they're close. Like if it were a distant cousin, I wouldn't care. If there's a story about the Huntsman family giving a large grant to the Huntsman Cancer Institute, then I need to disclose that. I need to disclose the relationship because I believe in transparency. So I don't know how it is with other institutions, but for me, I feel very lucky to have an owner publisher who understands, like, there's a firewall here and I'm not gonna go. That doesn't mean that I don't get an earful. I can't believe that headline. Oh my gosh, you know what happened? But it's always after the fact. Oh, that Bagley cartoon, that's outrageous. Okay, it's after the fact, you know, whatever. Sorry, didn't like it. That's the way it goes.
So I'm a journalism major also, and one of the things we often talk about is framing and how big a deal that can be. As a more historical example, during Katrina, like, white people gathering food were called survivors.
That's right.
Black people gathering foods and supplies were called looters. That still happens today. Do you think that's as big as an impact as it was? Do you think it still has as much effect as anything else you've talked about today?
I think that reporters, editors need to remain hypervigilant. When you look at an issue, and that's part of why there's this editorial layer. looking at it from a different perspective. Sometimes the reporter gets immersed in a topic and they start using the language of, say, the police. You know, an officer involved shooting, track down a suspect. I mean, it sounds like a police report rather than an officer shot a teenager. You know, that's the way we talk. We don't want to always talk like officials. We don't always want to use terms that have shades of meaning. So I think the framing part is something that we all need to be thinking about actively all the time. And that can get down to specific words. Like, I've taken a single word out of something that I said, you know what? That has a connotation that you may not have meant, but somebody reading this could interpret it that way. So yeah, I mean, I think that's an issue as much today as it ever was.
What would you say is the most effective means of de-incentivizing publishing content just for the sake of gaining traction and pushing an agenda? Especially like these days on the internet, you see a lot of things like, for example, like YouTube's algorithm, right? Like they push videos that gain traction regardless of the content. How would you say is the best way to combat that, be it, you know, national organizations or local, from basically kind of taking the wind out of their sails for putting things up, rather, you know, good or bad, if they just do it for the sake of gaining traction versus actually reporting credible news so we can try and avoid that mistrust?
I think that's part of the algorithm scrutiny that we're seeing right now. It's like, how much can technology, how much can artificial intelligence help solve this problem? I think it will solve some of the problems. One thing that we've done, we've hired a local company, a developer, to find a different way for us to have comments and have civil comments be rewarded and the cesspool trolls be punished. I think technology can go so far, but at the end of the day, I still have to have somebody who's managing it. So the human touch, I don't know if it can ever be eliminated in this and have the results that we want.
Kind of building on that last question, I understand the algorithm plays a large role in what stories get showed, but how much concern do you have for what I see as almost an uptick in what we're willing to believe as news consumers?
Your question is how concerned am I, or?
Like, do you think it's a big problem that we're more willing to believe these conspiracy theories or fringe reporting that I think we're seeing more and more?
Yeah. Again, I mean, you can share whatever you want. And your circles, depending on what they believe, might believe it if they don't do a little bit of homework. I do feel the pressure has shifted significantly onto the news consumer. You guys are the ones who are going to have to be smart, media literate, discriminating, and it's going to take more time. It's going to take more focus. It takes more energy rather than just letting the news wash over you and you believe everything. I think, sadly, the burden has shifted. And yes, the platforms, yes, the producers have responsibility, but you as consumers also do. And I hope that you can share that, particularly with your peers and younger, because there's a startling study out of Stanford, I want to say it was 2016 or 2017, the vast majority of young people, I think it was upwards of 80%, just believe whatever they see, whether it's photo, a video, a story, a headline. It's truth. And that, to me, scared me because, again, information is foundational to our democracy. We as citizens rely on it to make informed and empowered choices. And if we are not using critical thinking skills to actually decide what's fake and what's real, we're in a lot of trouble as a country and a world. On that happy note, you've been terrific. Thank you for all the questions. Love it.
This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.